Welcome to Piano Inspires podcast, celebrating pianists, teachers, and innovators as they share their inspiring stories about the transformative power of music.
Hello, I'm Craig Sale, senior editor with Piano Magazine and director of online courses for the Francis Clark Center. And it gives me great pleasure today to get a chance to talk with Connor Chi. Connor is a Navajo pianist and composer and is known for combining his classical piano training with his Native American heritage. Connor made his Carnegie Hall debut at the age of 12 after winning a gold medal in the World Piano Competition. He's a graduate of the Eastman School of Music and the University of Cincinnati's College Conservatory of Music. And his solo piano music, beautiful music, is inspired by traditional Navajo chants and songs. He has released 4 studio albums of original pieces and piano transcriptions of Navajo music. The Navajo Piano, which was released in 2014, won Best Instrumental Recording at the 16th Annual Native American Music Awards, and the piece Beginnings won Best New Age Song. Connor's 2020 release, Scenes from Dinete, features piano pieces written about elements of Navajo life and culture. And it was accompanied by the release of several music videos filmed on the reservation, directed by Navajo filmmaker Michael Etzitti, is that pronounced right? Etzitti Jr. So welcome, Connor. It's a real pleasure to get a chance to talk and about your life, where it began, where you are now, and what you're seeing for the future. So I'm looking forward to finding out more about all of that. So I'd like to start at the beginning, and about your childhood, your first experiences with music, first teachers. How did that begin for you?
You know, it's sort of strange because neither of my parents were musical. Mm-hmm. I started getting an interest in piano. Part of it was just through listening to some cassette tapes that my mom had, you know, the compilation albums of, I think, best of classical music. But I was drawn to them. I was maybe 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And around that time, my dad also got a little tiny keyboard as a gift for Christmas. I mean, he didn't play, but I was really fascinated with it. So, I took to it. I started trying to play by ear, and eventually my parents saw that I was interested and got me lessons. So that's kind of where it started. It was sort of out of nowhere.
Yeah. And so your first musical learning really was at the piano.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And did you have like one teacher for a long period of time or different teachers?
I had several different teachers. You know, it was hard to find a teacher where I was at. Mm-hmm. I was in Page, Arizona, which is a small town. It was even smaller back when I was growing up.
Yeah.
There was, I think, like one or two teachers. And they didn't really even have room. So I had one teacher for a little while. Eventually, my parents were having to drive me to Flagstaff, Arizona, which was a couple hours away, every weekend for a piano lesson. So it was a lot.
Yeah.
Especially for my parents carting me around just for a piano lesson when I was a kid. And, they didn't really know how serious I was about it at the time. So.
Uh-huh. And were you improvising at the time and composing from an early age, or were you just sort of going with the curriculum of the teacher?
I started by improvising and playing by ear, things that I heard on the television or the radio, and then making up my own music. I did have a teacher in school that when she saw I was interested, she helped me write a few things down because I had no idea how, you know.
Sure.
And I did that for a while until, I want to say I was about maybe 11 or 12, that I sort of backed away from it. I think as I got further in education and I was really focused on piano performance, I had some teachers that were that had said, you know, you don't know enough about composition, really. You know, you need all of these other things to be a composer. Mm. And so I kind of just gave up on that idea and sort of was like, well, I don't know enough theory. I don't know enough about, you know, form and structure. And I just totally focused only on the performance for a long time, actually, yeah. until after, you know, I got my master's degree.
But well, we're lucky that they're telling you that at an early age didn't stop you from that later on. You know,
yeah.
For a lot of children, that could be the kicker for them to just say, oh, this isn't something that I'm going to do. And then you get preoccupied with other things. So we're lucky, and I know you're blessed to be able to have gone back to that and explored it. I'm curious about, first of all, to win a competition at age 12, you must have excelled very quickly at the piano. Tell me a little bit more about that whole experience.
Well, eventually my parents got me a real piano. Uh-huh. There was a piano company, I think, that was based out of Utah. And every so often they'd have a truck of pianos. They'd drive, you know, from Utah down through Arizona uh-huh. to a lot of the small towns. And yeah. They came through, and my parents, after I'd been taking lessons for a little while, bought a piano for me. And so when I was 10, after all of this back and forth going to Flagstaff and Page every weekend, my mom's originally from Cincinnati, and they have a performing arts school there that she knew about. So when I was 10, they basically gave me the option to audition and see if I could get in. And if I was accepted, you know, then move to Cincinnati, which is what happened.
Oh,
so,
really?
Okay. My parents made a huge sacrifice for me to be able to wow. continue studying music when I was 10.
And so the whole family moved?
Yeah.
Wow. That is a commitment.
That was definitely a turning point for me, because that was, you know, even though I was 10, that was a moment when I really had to decide, am I serious about music?
Right.
Because, you know, that was a lot for them to sacrifice just for me to have better music education.
Absolutely. Right. My goodness. Yeah. I am curious about your impressions as you were a child with music, because I'm assuming you were raised on one of the regular method series type things, and that your training was in this classical vein and so forth. But, you know, earlier in your childhood, I'm wondering, did you have any reaction to material in whatever series it was, that was supposedly Native American music or pieces? Was that something that was jarring in any way to you, or you know, incompatible?
Yeah, you know, I think for so much of my life I had compartmentalized everything, where there was, you know, my piano world, my piano life, and then you know, my home life, or my heritage that I had, I think for a long time, sort of taken for granted. It was just, you know, I didn't realize until after I left Arizona that it wasn't the normal culture. And so, you know, I encountered those things. And as a child, I didn't really think as much of it, other than I had no connection to it. And it was just like a cartoonish
right.
display that right. was, you know, really not accurate. And I think it wasn't really until I was a little older that I started to understand the problem with it, because I started to realize that people that were not from an area that was close to a reservation or mm-hmm. didn't encounter any indigenous people, that was their perception, that they thought
right.
that we were the cartoon character. And mm-hmm. For me, it was obvious that it was just, you know, totally
not
accurate. It was just, you know, totally ridiculous. But, you know, as I got older and encountered mm-hmm. more people, and as I started teaching and encountered other students, I started to realize that there was this really skewed perception of what it was to mm-hmm. be an indigenous person,
yeah.
and that we were still around, and that we still yeah. existed, and that
yeah.
we weren't just this, you know, piece in a yeah. museum somewhere.
Right. I've heard you tell the story about some students that you encountered asking you what your heritage was, and if you're okay sharing that again, I think a heart-wrenching story, but it has great importance, and So if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, no, it was the first lesson that I had taught to a brother and sister. Mm-hmm. And so it was our first time meeting. And I think it was halfway through the younger brother's lesson that he sort of just stopped the lesson and said, "What are you? What are you?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Well, are you Chinese?" And his sister chimed in like, "No, obviously he's black." And I said, "No, actually I'm Navajo for the Navajo Nation." And he said, "You mean an Indian?" Uh-huh. And I said, "Well, I mean, we, you know, indigenous, or, you know, there's many different ways of saying it." He didn't believe me. He said, "No, that's you're joking, because all the Indians are dead." And it kind of caught me off guard for a minute. And and I was like, "No, that's not true." And he said, "Well, you know, you came here in a car. Like, do you live in a teepee? Like, you didn't, you know, you drove a car here." And I was like, "Wow." There was really no idea that we were still around and that we drove cars, or, you know, lived in a neighborhood just like everyone else. Yeah. You know, certainly there's a lot of things that are different, especially if, you know, like my dad's family is very traditional, and mm-hmm. living on the reservation is very different. But, you know, there are plenty of people that are not living on the reservation that live just like everyone else. And mm-hmm. that was a moment that it really hit me that there was this other perception.
Yeah. And it speaks volumes about how important experiences that are that children have, where they're supposedly exposed to other cultures. What about music in your youth? Because obviously your training, you were doing classical music. Were you still exposed to Native music around you as a child? Did you sense, were those compartmentalized too?
You know, it was. My earliest, you know, influences, other than, you know, what my parents would, you know, play on the radio, mm-hmm. Was my grandfather singing traditional songs. You know, before I could speak, he was singing traditional songs. And I was, you know, learning to dance to the traditional music that they would. If he wasn't actually singing it, they did have some recordings that they'd play. Mm-hmm. And on Navajo Nation Radio, like KTNN, mm-hmm. you know, they have all of the different traditional songs that they play. And so it was a mixture of things, but I'd never, again, it wasn't one of those things that I thought much about. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was until later in life, especially when I started composing and I started having other people pick apart my compositions, that I realized what an impact it had on me. Mm-hmm. the music that I listened to in my formative years, that even though I didn't think necessarily critically about it or mm-hmm. even realize it, the choices and things I was doing through instinct as a composer mm-hmm. were influenced by it.
Sure.
And it's interesting to me when people ask me about my music, or they dissect mm-hmm. it and you know, have questions, because they'll find things that I didn't realize that I was doing that are related, you know, that I just did instinctually. Not that I, you know, didn't understand the concept of what was happening, but it wasn't something that I thought, I'm reaching into, you know, this part mm-hmm. of my musical background for inspiration. It was, it's an interesting thing how that popped up even all of these years later.
It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like, though, that although your training went on this very traditional Western European canon training, there's was understanding and deep respect, though, for the native culture music that was a part of your life, but that was in a different place than your
I never really imagined it intersecting. I never really mm-hmm. it was just so different that I never even put the two things together. the approach to music and the way that my grandfather sang or treated uh-huh. rhythms and the melodies, it was just so different that it wasn't something I'd thought much about when I was studying you know, music theory and the Western ideas mm-hmm. of music theory.
But yet and you didn't, because I mean, speaking for myself, you know, when I got immersed in college and studying music, you know, there's a bit of snobbery that goes along with it, you know, that this, oh, I'm doing great art music. But it doesn't sound like there was that for you in terms of, this music is better than that. It's just that they coexisted, but they were different activities for you.
Right. And, you know, some of the things that I did read from, you know, ethnomusicologists that were very disparaging And I, you know, I remember coming across those things and thinking, oh, these people just don't get it. You know, it's pretty, it was kind of funny to me, but then, you know, the more I thought about it, the more it wasn't funny. And yeah. I think that's sort of what all of these little things sort of steered me down this path of where I'm at today, because it certainly wasn't intentional for me to, for one thing, be composing, and to be finding ways to combine my heritage and the classical piano world that I was so deep into, just on the other side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
But all of these little things sort of were, I think, nudging me in this direction.
So in college, your plan was to, it was performance, what was your goal? And what were, what happened during that time that then, not took you away from performance, but you added this whole composition component. How did that come about where, when you got out and started out this career, composition became such a major force?
You know, I was, during my master's degree, I mean, I think during my time in college, it was very tumultuous for me. And I didn't really know why. And I felt sort of without direction. And I was deeply unhappy and trying to kind of figure things out, as many people are around that time. And I think the culture that I was like so immersed in, the most toxic part of the classical music culture, I sort of made the decision to just kind of walk away from it and to go back home. And it was something I'd always planned to do, but, you know, where I was originally thinking, oh, I'm going to go pursue a DMA, I sort of was, you know, disillusioned it. And I thought, you know, this isn't right. There was just something inside me that said, you know, let's just take a break from this, this all, and walk away from it and pursue something that was important to me. And that was to find ways to preserve some of the music that my grandfather sang. Because a lot of it gets lost. It's passed down orally. And the language is, you know, getting lost. And so I wanted to take an opportunity to find a way to do that. So I was thinking of, you know, maybe writing these things down in sheet music form, but that just didn't feel right. And I was like, why would I do that? Who would that be for? You know, like my grandfather, you know, all of the traditional singers don't use sheet music. And that's kind of, you know, it runs counter to what that part of the culture is about, you know, the sharing things orally and passing things down. And so eventually what I just started doing was, you know, taking some of the songs and just trying to play them on the piano, which was a little challenging because there were things that my grandfather did with his voice that didn't quite work. And so I sort of was pushing things around and, you know, there also wasn't any harmony. So that was something that I started adding. And it was sort of this preservation project that turned into something else. And so where I started with a few things that were more or less just settings of the melodies, as I was sort of fitting those into a piano style and, you know, making little changes so it fit, then I started doing other things with these little compositional devices that were inspired by the ways that he would shift meter frequently or different ways that the themes were developed. And so what started as setting a few melodies actually turned into me starting to compose some original things and reaching back into that part of me that wanted to compose, you know, since I was a child, and you know, creating what was just for me was going to be just an album of these pieces that was kind of just for myself. But you know, I put it out there, and eventually, so people started getting interested in it. And they started asking me for sheet music, and which I didn't have because I did everything in my head. I was so it was sort of one by one. I'd be like, "Well, which one do you want to play?" And they'd tell me, and I'd write it down and send it out. And so little by little, people took this interest in it, and I sort of continued down the path. People were asking me, well, what's next? You did this album. Well, what's next? And that's when I thought, okay, well, I've been inspired by the traditional music, but I was also inspired by our traditional stories, our creation stories, and all of the things that are so interesting about the culture. And so I started looking for ways to take that and embed that in music as well. So it was this strange path that I took that was very roundabout to get where I'm at. But it just sort of had this natural flow, and things started to fall into place, and they felt better because, you know, when I was focusing only on performance, I felt out of place. I felt not necessarily that I belonged, but then as I was working on these projects that were really important to me, I started to find purpose. And so that was sort of like, okay, you found something. Now you found your a little bit of a direction. And so I, you know, still don't know what the next step is often, but, you know, I'm sort of guided by that feeling.
I mean, it clearly, it, you know, just speaking to you, it's clear that you found purpose, you found joy, in what you were doing, and the angst and struggle that you were dealing with earlier, you moved beyond that into something, and that's what makes it something that's right, and it's also something that's real, because it's yours.
Yeah.
Which I think we can all learn from. I'm curious, in using melodies and rhythms, stories, anyway, I believe I've heard you mention that there are certain things which are sacred. Yes. And so there are some parts that you don't use. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit about how
sure.
that works?
Sure. You know, music is such a big part in Diné Navajo culture. Mm-hmm. There's songs for, you know, riding your horse or when you're weaving, but there's also ceremonial songs. And so the music sort of permeates all these different spaces. And it's somewhat similar, I think, to secular religious music. But part of the oral tradition is because the Navajo people believe in the power of music.
Mm-hmm.
And so these sacred songs that are only for ceremony are just that, you know, they shouldn't be shared outside of that. And even a lot of the people that sing the songs don't practice them until they're in ceremony. It's,
oh,
you
wow.
practice it in your head until the next opportunity to actually sing it out loud. And there are also songs that are for certain times of the year that you're only supposed to sing, you know, during the winter. And so, you know, I try to be really cognizant of all of those things when I'm including music that I know is going to be streaming or going to be accessible to be played any time of the year or in any space.
Yeah.
So those were always considerations I took, and, you know, talking to my dad and talking to my grandfather and other relatives, everybody has a different opinion, but, you know, I do my best to find things that are going to be respectful and not overshare things that shouldn't be shared, you know, outside of the community and that are okay to be on, these platforms that we are in this day of technology where they're, you know, accessible by anyone at any time.
Right. How is your music received by the Diné people? Is it, first of all, do they know about it? Do they, you know, and are they excited? Are they, what's the reaction?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was really great for me when I started playing my compositions for people that came from the community, and it was always surprising to me that they caught on to the little things.
Did they? Yeah.
You know, I had a performance, I think last year, and it was in Michigan, but there was somebody there was a Navajo person in the audience that came up afterwards and was talking about, oh, they enjoyed the music and they could hear the female rain and the male rain. And I was like, wow, you know, it's not something I pointed out, but that's just something that we know about in the culture is different types of rain. And those were things that I tried to express, and I was really excited that that wasn't just something that I used to inspire the notes I was putting out. It was something that could actually be received by someone who was familiar with it and actually, you know, get it without being, you know, told about it.
Right.
And, you know, another thing that was really powerful for me was, you know, also when I was younger, I had a lot of really negative experiences with teachers because I was a native student. And
this was in Arizona?
In Arizona,
oh,
yeah.
Really?
I think I was like 8. I had a teacher that was really particularly not nice.
Okay.
And there was this idea that you had to be this super disciplined, practicing for 20 out of 24 hours a day, and had told me, you know, that you can do this, you know, for fun, but you're never going to do this professionally, you know, because you're an Indian and there's, you know, you don't have the discipline, you know, you're an American and Americans are lazy. So that's one thing, but you're an Indian. There aren't any other Indians that are in music like this. There's no way you can compete with the rest of the world. And that for me, luckily I didn't take that and just quit altogether. It sort of made me mad, and I had something to prove.
Okay,
know if that was a healthy reaction, but that it did sort of light a fire in me.
Yeah,
And I'd kind of forgotten about that for a long time, but you know, recently I had some other colleagues that were teaching on the reservation, sharing my music with the students, and one of the students was like, "Well, wait, he's Navajo." And they were like, yeah, also, so that means I can do this too. Yeah. And I thought, wow, that was powerful for me because I had gone this direction and was able to sort of, I don't know, pass this down to someone else and hopefully inspire them, because I think constantly of all the things I didn't do because I felt I wasn't good enough or I wasn't worthy or this was, you know, a pursuit that I just couldn't accomplish. So I'm excited to see a new generation that feels like they can do something. Like, what are they going to come up with when they have the right resources and the right fostering of their creativity and their talents?
Right. Well, and, you know, what that the teacher said those horrible things. I mean, one thing was true about it is there, you were like no others, especially when you went on pursuing music further. I mean, how many indigenous pianists like yourself were there.
Yeah.
You didn't see that. And unfortunately, the words of somebody like that take that experience and make it as if it's proof that they're right.
Right.
And it's no, it's just you haven't allowed this to happen. And I think, you know, I can say for myself that, you know, someone like you is, as you already know, is having impact on other young potential pianists or musicians, showing them, oh yeah, this can happen. It's so basic about, again, we go back to childhood and perceptions and what children are shown. You know, it can open up worlds of possibility for them.
And I, you know, I think often of just how fortunate I was that I had parents that were so dedicated to me pursuing the things that I had an interest in, because that was a lot to give up for a 10-year-old.
That's right.
That says he's gonna practice. Yeah. Like, oh yeah, right. But you know, that's a big problem, is the resources aren't there. I mean, lot of parents, not necessarily that they would have chosen to not get lessons, they just couldn't. You know, I was
You
know, my parents were driving me 2 hours to somewhere else just for a piano lesson once a week. I mean, that's not a reality for a lot of people, even if they wanted to.
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate in how the stars aligned and that I had parents that were so supportive. And so that was, you know, something that I always think about and want to make sure I try to give back and create other opportunities for students that that maybe aren't in the same situation that I was, that had these opportunities, that we have to bring those opportunities to them. It's important.
Yeah. Which brings me to a project which I'm familiar with, that is an exciting one, where the with the Francis Clark Center, you're along with Renata Yazzi leading a project of commissioned works by indigenous composers for young piano students, for elementary students. We've been working on the project together, but one thing we haven't talked about is, what does this project mean to you? Partly, you know, what do you hope to achieve by it, but also on a more personal level, what meaning does that hold for you?
I think it's important on so many levels. I think the first is the level of communication, because music is a great way to communicate and to foster curiosity. That's something that with my music I try to do, and I'm always surprised at the conversations that open up with other cultures and things that I learn about other people, because they found something in the music that relates to Diné culture that also relates to some aspect of their unique background. And those are the conversations that are so important to really be able to celebrate the diversity and what makes everybody unique and what they can bring to the table. Specifically in the indigenous communities, I think it's important because it shows possibility. You know, they are seeing things that are placed in front of them that they can say, hey, maybe I want to do this someday. Maybe I want to be a composer. Maybe I want to play piano. Or, you know, these are things that are, there's a place for us you know? And it's important for students to see that, that there is a place for them if they want to pursue music or whatever avenue it is. And that wasn't the case because in the past, you know, the representation was so flawed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really a representation. It was more of a mockery.
Yeah.
That had, you know, a negative impact.
They have representation that's not a cartoon.
Right.
Something that they can actually relate to. And then I'll flip it to the other side. I think it's important for those students who you had these misconceptions of Native Americans, for students to have real things presented to them. It makes it so that they're not so ignorant,
right.
to put it bluntly.
Right.
Yes. And I do want to mention, too, one of the other fascinating things in your career, this is kind of a shift here, but is some of the multimedia aspects of some of your work, the videos that you did, which incorporated your music and the videos, and those were, I think, shot on the reservation, right?
Yes.
And I remember that I've seen the one on Fry Bread where you're watching it made and all of that. I'd love to hear a bit of your thoughts on what you hope to achieve with that and just the whole multimedia aspect. You know, was that something that was fun? Is that something that you want to continue to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, I was at first inspired just by the changing nature of how we consume music and the platforms that it's on. It's not just on the radio and you're not just putting your headphones on. You're seeing something visually.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something I didn't have in my music before. And I was always, you know, very, I avoided being on camera or all those kinds of things. So it was hard for me to do. But, you know, it was like I can either just say, no, I'm not going to do it and, you know, be cast aside or, you know, move with the way that the culture's moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a music video that was very simple, but we shot it out in the reservation where my family's from, which was an interesting experience, having a piano out in the middle, middle of the desert. But people enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me thinking about, you know, I was thinking about my next set of pieces, my next album. And I wanted to show, you know, not just to share the music, but that was an opportunity visually to show people what life was kind of like today. Because again, there was this idea that either we don't exist anymore or we're this piece of history. And it's, you know, it's interesting. I think people are interested to see how we have this really rich heritage that we can also incorporate in the modern world. And so that was something I wanted to do, is show a little bit of, you know, things that I'd seen growing up, but that not everyone else had, and parts of the country and where I was originally from, you know, that was a great way to share that. And I was super fortunate that my good friend Michael at City just happened to be, and this was during COVID. You know, he actually was supposed to be going to the Philippines and ended up being quarantined at my place. And it was just, it was three of us, four of us that, you know, we were in the house together and I was pushing this album back. And then I realized this is, you know, not going to be just a couple weeks. This is going to be something long term. And so we actually ended up planning these music videos and shooting it. I think we did it all in like 4 days.
Oh my goodness.
A bunch of videos.
Wow.
And it kind of worked out. And he actually was someone that I'd met when I was younger through piano lessons. Like when I first started out, we had piano lessons together when I think it was just for a couple months before my parents had to start taking me out of town. But, you know, we'd reconnected and he had a real sense for music and he had a real sense for visually what I didn't envisioned when I was composing these pieces, and all those little moments that when you're watching the videos and the music syncs up perfectly with, you know, whatever the activity is or whatever you're seeing on the screen, he just latched onto that instantly. And so it was really exciting for me to have that process and to have somebody who also was a creative person and had sort of their own vision of things that they could add to it. So that's definitely something I want to continue.
Good, good, because they're beautiful. I love the way they're very poetic and beautiful. Love it. So I know currently, you know, you're busy performing, doing presentations, writing, all that stuff. What What do you see coming next?
Sometimes I get so caught up in the moment, and it's not always a bad thing.
Because that's true. You know, 'cause the moment's important.
I think I spent so much time looking into the future with fear of what's going to happen next that I, if I'd have kept doing that, I probably wouldn't be where I'm at. So I'm sort of in a different place now where I'm not trying to get too caught up in the future. Obviously, there's things that are important to me,
sure.
things about my music that are important, but I'm really fortunate right now to have sort of opportunities that can also guide me to where I'm going next, to unexpected right. places, because I feel, I mean, just a few years ago, if I'd have wanted to be where I'm at today, I would have had no idea how to get here. You know, yeah. there was no clear path. Uh-huh. There wasn't one thing that I was going to do to get here. Uh-huh. And so that's kind of the exciting part, is I have no idea what I'm going to be doing next. I don't know, a year from now or 2 years.
Well, it's working
from now.
Just fine for you. that's the thing. And you make a good point there about worrying too much about where you want to be impeding your work.
I think, you know, there was so much structure that's been put in place for musicians, especially in the classical world, where it's like, this is what you do. And there was a lot of times I didn't even stop to ask myself why, you know, like, mm-hmm. why do I want to continue with my DMA? Is that for me? And I realized it wasn't, but I was going to do that just because that's the path you take. That's what you do next.
Exactly.
You know, I'm going to start my auditions for the next thing, and then I'm going to do this. And so, you know, having structure is great, but also I think something that I really embraced was possibility and not having to cling to any one thing. And it's a little scary, but also exciting. And so I'm finding a way to balance that of having structure and a plan and also being open to change and being open to other things that might take me into a totally different direction that maybe I'm not comfortable with at first, but you know, that's exciting.
Yeah. Well, and that's a wonderful example, particularly for younger musicians who still are raised with that idea of this is, you know, how you should go about charting your life, to see how there are options beyond that set path.
Yeah, it's important. You know, I don't want to disparage that, because that is a really, you know, admirable path that works very well for many people, but it didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And I just never taken a moment to realize that that's okay.
Yeah,
that's right. I could do something else.
Yeah.
So.
And the other, sort of circling back, the other beautiful thing about your path that you've been on is that you were able to circle back and incorporate part of your heritage, and in that way find joy and more wholeness really in your work. So I we end all of these with one question here. and that question is, how does piano inspire you?
I think, you know, the more that I've spent time at the piano, the more that I'm constantly amazed by possibility. Because sometimes, especially when I'm composing, I'm sitting there, you know, looking for inspiration. And it's incredible to me that this one instrument for so long, you know, we're still coming up with new things, still coming up with new ideas, new music, and also watching other people sit at the instrument, and it's incredible how the same instrument that I might sit at and do something, you know, it becomes a part of someone else, and I can be really mesmerized by the things that I'm like, oh, I wish I could do that. I wish I could play this way. You know, it's exciting and it's pretty incredible. So for me, you know, it inspires possibility. It seems at first glance, maybe it's limiting because there's only so many keys. There's only, you know, so many. Well, it's really not true. It's kind of limitless. So it's an interesting balance between having the constraints of what you can do at the piano, but also the fact that we're still coming up with new things after all this time. And I'm still amazed when I see someone else who does a different type of music or a different style or a different technique or comes from a different place. That possibility is what really inspires me to continue.
Yeah. Well, and your life to this point demonstrates that, you know, how piano can do that, and how we hope it will do that for so many people. So I want to thank you, Connor, for this time with us to talk and share so much. And more importantly, thank you for all that you're doing currently and in the future. It's beautiful music. If anybody listening has never listened to your music, they need to, or go to YouTube and there's the videos are there. But it's just wonderful contributions to the art, but also to the education of young musicians. And there's many, many great things yet to come out of it. And it's wonderful to have you be a part of that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And I have to say, you know, thank you for everyone that's involved in all the many things at the Francis Clark Center. But it's so great to have a place that feels like I belong. And that there are things, you know, that there's so many important things that are possible in the right environment. And this, the culture of this whole, everything that's going on is so positive. And so I really appreciate that and the opportunity to speak.
And we are thrilled to be a place for you to be and to grow. So thank you so much.
The Francis Clark Center is a not-for-profit educational organization that serves the advancement of piano teaching, learning, and performing. Divisions include Piano Magazine, Piano Inspires Kids, Journal for Piano Research, National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy, the New School for Music Study, Piano Education Press, International Online Teacher Education, and Piano Inspires Online Community Hub. Please visit us at pianoinspires.com to learn more about our impactful work and inspiring community.